So should we start with maybe discussing how you came to be in the peace movement?
Yes, it started before Greenham, the sort of CND and going on marches in London. So that was always sort of part of my, you know, my belief system. And I remember when I was 16 joining Greenpeace. My dad was part of it, and I just remember at 16 being very aware that was quite important work. And then that sort of naturally led on to the sort of CND movement. And being an art college student, very much, you know, that was part of where I was. And yeah, so I think it was no surprise that it was going to lead into sort of what I felt about wanting to be part of Greenham. Mm. And it was a natural sort of stepping stone, I think.
And what was the sort of moment that you decided you were going? What was it that made you?
Yeah, well, I think I wanted to go before, but I was pregnant, like your good self, and I felt, you know, that sense of vulnerability and protection. So I felt my heart was there, but my physical presence felt, you know, I didn't want to do that. It felt my intuition said no, it's really important to be safe with this baby. And I still felt that when he was born, Joe was born in 1981, end of 1981, where it was all beginning. And we were living in London, in Brixton, in the time of the riots. That was quite interesting. I was at Goldsmiths just finishing a teaching degree. And then moving down to be with my parents, that was outside of Reading. And it was only by moving into Reading eventually that I joined the Women's Centre sort of childcare group and started to meet like-minded, because I didn't know anybody, sort of like-minded women. And who's a very close friend now, she started the Reading Greenham Women's Support Group.
Right.
And that's how I got involved, really.
Was it through a sort of feminist lens that you became involved, or more of a...
Yeah, both. I think both. It is all-encompassing, you know. It's interesting, I've been reflecting on, as an older woman now, and this woman, you know, I was in my sort of mid-20s. What was all that about? You know, what was that whole instinctual sense of... I was called, drawn there, I think on lots of levels. And I, I split up from my husband in that time when Joe was three. And again, I think, you know, when you're going through that phase, you're looking for sisterhood and support from women, and women in similar situations, and women in general, I think. So that was very empowering. So it was really an easy sort of route to begin, you know. I didn't have to even try. It was like falling on my lap, and it felt right. Mm. And I think it was great to support, because I knew, having, you know, such a tiny child, I didn't really want to take him to be, and I breastfed till he was three, so I was very much involved in that. So the sort of bringing him up was my my priority. But each time I could have, I would go, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So did you go on weekends, or whenever you?
Yeah. So the support group was very much, we decided to support Bluegate.
Right. Okay.
Because they were quite vulnerable. They were, as in, right on the road. That's where the bailiffs and munchers would come and take all the stuff away the next morning.
Munchers being the bins.
So they would, all their cookery stuff, everything, bedding, sort of benders would just all be put in. So it was a very...
And when was this? Do you remember what year?
It must have been about 1983, 84.
Okay.
And I think, you know, sort of seeing how do they live then? How can they live when their home has been taken away every morning going into winter? So our support group really was, we did this thing called Night Watch, where we would go two nights a week and have, like, I think it was, what was the timing? 8 until 2. That was one group of women. And then 2 till 6. So we changed over, so the women could go to sleep, to go to bed, and we would sit around the fire, keep the fire going. And if there was, you know, anybody going to disturb them or cruise missiles coming, we would wake them up. And so we were sort of there to make sure they slept.
And you did that for a couple of years?
Yeah. So, and that was quite amazing, you know, just being almost like, I don't know what the right word is, but just there to support and help and protect, like guardians in a way. It was quite interesting. And to allow them their safety of sleep and energy for what they were choosing. You know, they were putting their lives in Green and Common every day, and that wasn't my choice because I had a little child. That was my priority. So, and the more I went there, the more I got more intrigued about, you know, like I was stepping out of when I felt I wasn't no longer breastfeeding, I felt I could sort of do a little bit more, you know, that felt right. And so the first thing was an action which was quite powerful to me, was that we decided, our little group, we would go in on bonfire night and let off fireworks on common ground. So we obviously decided, November the 5th, we were going to do that. And so, of course, you have to sort of think of, actually, you know, most of us had to get back for our kids to take them to nursery and school. So we had to get childcare, you know, that whole support system. We had to get, and there were women who weren't prepared to go in, but they were happy to hang around in cars all around the base. Because I was just saying to my friend recently, I was thinking, we didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have phones in those days. So you couldn't say, right, meet you at Blue Gate. Because if you're being chucked out by the army and the police, they could chuck you out anywhere. And it's a very wide perimeter. But for the grace of God, you know, I just knew I had to get back for 7 o'clock to take Joe to nursery. You know, that was my thought. I've got to do that.
Yeah.
So we were obviously, we went in, and for me, it was the scary bit was running across this massive runway. It just seemed forever, like ants on a, you know, tiny ants sort of scrabbling across, and then lying down when the lights would come round, and the searchlights sort of getting on our bellies, and then we got onto the grass, and then we said, right, okay, let's let off some fireworks, let's actually celebrate this night. And we were obviously having a great time. We all knew what our names were. My name was Catherine Wheel. There's all sorts of funny false names, and thinking, yeah, we're doing really well here. And then we were arrested, and this was, I don't know, must have been about 10 o'clock at night, and that started to feel a bit scary, you know, guys with 6 foot guns.
What were you specifically being arrested for? What were you doing?
Because we shouldn't have been there, you know, that whole thing of, you know, this is, you know, we're arresting you because you're on this. Yeah, exactly. So as a group, you feel very strong, you're singing all the songs, and you feel that, you know, you can cope. And then the next minute, and then they say, who are you? And they didn't get my name at first. I didn't see the joke of why I chose that name. Then they separate you, and that's when you start to feel very vulnerable. You start to think, oh.
So where were you then?
Somewhere in the middle of the bay, somewhere in an office. So they
in a porter cabin.
Yeah, so they drove us to, you know, a porter cabin, and started to take details. Who are you? Where do you live? What's your name? and obviously put it through the whole court proceedings, and then they said, we know your name isn't Catherine Weir. What is your name? So, of course, I had to say what my false name was. And then at that point, I thought, I just need to get out. I need to get back. And I didn't know where they were going to drop me off. Like I said before, you had no idea where they were going to just drop you off. And luckily, there was somebody in a car waiting. So that was, you know, because I don't know what I would have done. I would have walked back to Reading, you know, which would have taken me all night. So that was really interesting, that sense of really feeling the fear, because there was a lot of fear, personally, for me. And I think when you do have a child, your whole fear thing goes into another level. You know, before that, you know, fear is, it seems so different, and now you're going, actually, this isn't just about me. Actually, I am here about me and what I care about and affecting everybody on the planet, but actually there's a little person that I'm sort of responsible for. So that was always my priority. I had to keep getting back for that. So that sort of felt for me quite a powerful thing to have stepped out into, and then going to court, being able to stand up and say, yeah, you know, I guess this is what I've done. And I think it would have been easy to go, no, I'm not going. I didn't have to go to court. They didn't know what. They just thought my address was Green and Common, so they couldn't find me. They couldn't find me and my name. So, but I think it was really important to be counted. You know, the whole point was that, you know, if you talk to the women that were living there, it was a sense that we want to really make their lives awkward in the court. We want to give them some work. They're not doing any work, and all this is going on. So, it was supporting that. And I was reflecting with my friend who started the Green Support Group. I was saying that... the Green and women who'd lived there day in, day out, day in, were quite different from us sort of visitors, because a lot of women were visitors, weren't they? If you're talking with women that came all over
really
the world.
Important. Yeah.
And but they were just different. They were just like really quite bolshy and strong, and you know, it's like that's where they lived, and so it became their home, and we sort of almost kept coming into their home. You know, yeah. They welcomed us, so it had a very different energy, different
And how did you feel about, because by then Greenham was women only, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How did you feel about that? I mean, I know you had male visitors in the day. What was that like, the experience of women only?
Yeah, no, I think that's what I was saying initially. I think, you know, being a single parent, having a lot of women friends, it felt a really good space. I think you start to realise that, you know, there's no hierarchy, there's no... body telling you what to do, the whole patriarchal thing, and arguments and who wants to be in charge, and that's what happens in a lot of groups of men, you know, the loud voices and trying to sort it all out and take charge. It was very much that sort of collaborative, collective, peaceful, kind, easy, well, sisterhood really. And I think for me that was probably the first time I'd sort of felt that in such a way. Do you know what I mean? From my Reading group, as well as the women there and women I met, and the whole sense that I was part of something was much bigger than I could ever imagine, really, which was fantastic.
Did you always stay at Blue Gate?
Yeah, well, yeah, so that was our main gate that we supported, but we liked to, so we did other things like, oh, let's go and visit, so Red Gate, that was just along a bit, was right on the main road, and nobody lived there because it was just the gate and then gravel and then the road, so it would be really hard. So we used to go sort of the other side of the road and make a fire and make some sort of presence that we were there. I think I've got a few pictures of that, and do things on the fence and everything. Yeah, and there was one weekend, a whole lot of us said, let's... I think there was some demonstration action going on or celebrations, and we said, why don't we create our own gate, our own colour? So we went between blue and green. I said, oh, what about aquamarine, you know? So that's what we did. And we made a bender and we took stuff for the weekend. So that was amazing to sort of create that for ourselves. But we got too near the fence and the... soldiers kept lobbing loads of rocks at us, and I thought, oh, I don't
rocks.
Need, yeah, like sort of big stones just lobbing. I thought,
did
I
re- hit any of
well, almost, you know. So I said, I think we should move the bender back, you know. I said, no way, I'm going to go to sleep, you know, knowing that something could be
hitting you in the skull.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, so that was great to sort of experience that. Obviously, not like the sort of women there that all the time, but to sort of feel, to have a glimmer, a sense of how it was.
Were there,
you know,
particular people, and you don't need to name them, but just were there particular people that really stood out to you as inspiring, that changed your...
Well, I think, I mean, Blue Gate, I don't know if you know, but they were basically 19-year-olds. So Blue Gate was all about, you know, the young lesbians that were really angry and were doing all kinds of things, you know, that at weekends would go to London, and when sex shops were those sort of secretive funny little places and they put super glue in the locks, they were always doing something. They were the radical ones.
Yeah.
And we just so happened to be supporting that gate. So I think it was being around them, it was quite extraordinary to see that energy, to see a sense where they were quite invincible, and that's allowed you to go, yeah, wow, you know, I'm not like that at the moment. You know, I can feel like that, but I don't know if I could just do that. But it began to rub off a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it felt like we started doing things in... Because Reading at that point was a really political place. That there was this alternative anarchist magazine that we were in part, that was supporting Green. You know, there's articles written by Greenham every single week, and I was doing the design, and you know, your miners' strike things, and there was a very.
Why do you think that was happening in Reading? The sort of political. Fervor?
I think because there was a certain group of people that were just wanting to form a collective, really, and so you can look at Red Rag, the archives, and virtually every week I was looking at it and thinking, oh my god, I did that cover, oh my god, that's my writing. Oh, you know, I was thinking, I didn't realize, and I was looking at, like, there's always something happening every day, you know, some sort of political thing.
Do you feel like Reading's like that now?
No. Well, it may be, but there's no magazine, there's no... It was quite extraordinary, actually, for that time. It felt like that was the life I was leading. You know, it's like, where are we going now? What's going on? And obviously having a little child in tow.
How did your parents or family or partner feel about your political engagement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was at a time where... Yeah, so that was the other thing, because, you know, I've got a good relationship with my parents. But my dad, what came up for me was this, God, he's just... really sexist, and he's just always talking about himself. You know, I just went through that phase of really recognizing that. Definitely an awakening. And so on my 30th birthday, I just told him what I thought, really, but in a very articulate way. I wasn't ranting at him, you know, I wasn't getting angry. I was getting, my voice is getting louder. So I just, in addition, you just need to listen to me, Dad, you know, because I was saying the truth. I wasn't being angry for angry's sake. But it's a sense where I needed to say that. And I think that was very much, you know, and then my hair was probably a bit longer than it was. And it got shorter and shorter and shorter. And then I got a number two. I was like looking like Sinead O'Connor. And then my little boy had the same cut. We both had a little tiny plait that remains of the long hair. And that was great to do as well, that sense of... being very comfortable with my face. I didn't need my hair to hide my face, that I actually quite liked my face, and I felt strong, you know. And I think as a single parent, you know, you're sort of looking for a sense of, you know, some inner strength about all that.
Yeah.
And I knew quite a lot of single parents, and again, they were in the Green and Sport group. So it was, and then I met a lot of, obviously, with the Women's Centre, I met a lot of lesbians. So that became another, just this amorphous group, actually, that, you know, women coming together for all kinds of reasons. And I think when, yeah, but Bluegate, it was. I mean, if we'd have gone to Yellowgate, which we did sometimes, you're talking to the elders that were represented, they were the representatives on the sort of media.
Did you know any of them?
No, not really. We didn't really, I talked to them, but I didn't really know them. And each gate had a character, so like Violet Gate was where all the hippies went, you know, that was all tucked away, and so they felt safe, they could take their children and create their community.
Yeah.
And it was great that each colour gate had
character,
and you could put yourself where you wanted. So it was interesting, people with this sort of 19-year-olds were raging, and I think it was, in a way, it was like, because I'm very much involved in mental health now because I teach mindfulness, and I think that's where a lot of women went to find something to help them, you know, their well-being, their mental health.
Yeah.
You know, you could see that some were really suffering, but they found something there for them.
Do you think that had an impact on your choice to be involved with mental health?
Well, I was an art teacher. I got back into art teaching, and then I got into trying to be an acupuncturist. So I got into healing. So healing became my passion, then I started to see the male and female energies in a different way, because it was very easy to be at Greenham and to have that sort of, you know, men are bastards, men are trash, or, you know, that's that sort of what you did at that point, you know. And I think, well, I've got to be careful with this. I've got a little boy, and I can't keep saying that because he's going to be a little man one day. But it was a phase that you have to go through to come out and see the wider aspect. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I think acupuncture got me into healing, and that's what carried on really now.
And I suppose that relates to MBDA, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
What were your feelings about MBDA? Are your feelings about it?
In terms of what?
Well, did you have much experience of it at Greenham?
Not a lot, really. I mean, I was very much in my bubble of... just when I sort of look back, I think if I'd have gone now, it'd have been so different. I was quite a different person then.
Yeah. So were you early 20s, were you?
Well, sort of mid-20s. Yeah. I had Joe when I was 24. And I think it really... Yeah, it was, like you said, it was an awakening. It was a sense of, wow, nothing's happened like this before in my life. I've had to do other things that I've had to show my courage and bravery and strength. But this was very different. This was very, very different. And it was like each step I was learning another aspect of myself in that and the sort of, the collective, really. But it was, and I'm very... And sort of when I talk about it to other people, I feel very proud I was there because I could have easily not been there.
Yeah.
When I think about, that crossroads.
It would have been easier probably to not be.
Yeah, I think if I hadn't have had Joe, I would have been there in a very different capacity.
Yeah.
You know, I might have been living there, I might have been, or doing all sorts.
Yeah.
But I think, having a child sets you on a different path, not completely. So I feel very, I feel very blessed, very grateful that I chose to explore that, really.
And how many times were you arrested?
Only that once.
Only that once,
I didn't really feel... I think, again, it's just because of having a small child and, choosing that. I mean, I was talking to my friend
Lots of women said that.
Yeah.
And you're juggling...
Yeah, you just go, actually, they're your sort of priority, really, and they shouldn't really... There shouldn't be a compromise around that. So it's that balance that you're seeking to be who you are and what you want to do, and then this other little person that you really are you're caring for.
Yeah.
I've never really spoke to my son and said, "What did you, perhaps I should?" He's just had a child. I'm a grandmother. What was his recollections of what did he feel? I mean, he was quite young, so he's probably he probably thought. I mean, I think kids of that age just go with the flow, don't they? He loved poking fires. So there's a picture of him I've got, just always poking the fire. The fascination with fires.
What did you feel thinking both as a Greenham woman, but also as a parent? What was the threat of nuclear like in the 80s for you?
Yeah, again, it was scary. These weapons of mass destruction, cruise missiles going on roads which are quite little around Newbury, we're not a million miles from Newbury. And not being selfish, you just think, God, well, we would have been massively hit, as well as everything else.
Do you remember seeing the cruise missiles?
Yeah, no, I remember sort of, sitting tight in front of the gates to stop it coming in. And just being moved away by the police,
What were they like to look at? Do you remember?
Yeah, they're just... The feeling, they were just huge, really. They're much bigger than you could anticipate.
Could you give us a sort of comparison?
No, not really. There's nothing that compares. I think because of the feeling of what they were carrying. I think it had this exaggerated substance which felt horrid and scary and wrong. And you were just so tiny, really. But you weren't tiny because you were... This group sitting.
You wonder how the drivers must have felt as well, carrying that.
Yeah, exactly. Cargo. I know, and they must have just put themselves into. They were like carrying fish fingers or something. I wonder if they put themselves in that mindset, because if you think about it too much.
What was your relationship like with soldiers, police, while you were there?
Yeah, well, I wasn't Bolshy then. I would have been Bolshy now, probably. I think I was sort of feeling, again, it's that thing of being this young mother. I just didn't want to be too Bolshy. Like a lot of women around me. So I just practiced sort of non-violent communication, really, because I didn't want anything.
So, could you give us an example of memory?
I wasn't quiet, but I sort of chose my words rather than some of the agreements just didn't care what they said. Not didn't care, they did care. That's why they said it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was my like, my God, they said that. Whereas I would say that now, but I just felt vulnerable because where I was really, and but I wasn't afraid to, you know, to talk. But I didn't use the language which I probably would have liked to have used.
Yeah.
It's weird that, isn't it, really? Because I'm the person
it's
I'm
age,
now.
I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it, I, you know, I've sort of... yeah, I feel a different person. It'd be great to go back now, actually. I know exactly what I would do. Not that I wasn't doing anything then, because I was, you know.
What did you think about all the Extinction Rebellion stuff yesterday?
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, I would have... part of me would like to be involved in that. I think as you get older, I mean, I'm 61, you just go, so many choices we have, and my work is very much about helping people. Do you know what I mean? I've just been training to do mindfulness for self-compassion, which is much more powerful than mindfulness. And it is about looking at people's mental health in a way yeah. that is crucial at the moment, much yeah. more than it was in the 80s, I think.
In what way?
I just think because... the world is spinning at this extraordinary rate, and there's pressure and identity and social media, and I think the problems seem very different from my perspective. Mm. And what I teach mindfulness in schools, and I'm a consultant for the Goldie Hawn Foundation, so I'm seeing it in schools.
What's that about the Goldie Hawn?
Yeah, so it's basically, she started this 13 years ago in the States as a result of seeing that children weren't happy. So how do you get children happy in schools? You know, there was absenteeism, and there was a massive drug problem. So she threw all her money and celebrity at getting neuroscientists, positive sort of research workers and teachers. And bringing together a curriculum to take into schools to teach neuroscience, mindful awareness, so children understand how their brain works in order to help them, help their mental health, and positivity, gratitude and kindness starts changing the brain. And children work, but then children can work and be happy. It's as simple as that, really. Mm. So we go around and deliver this program to schools all over the country. And so I've seen it in school. I think mental health in schools is absolutely rocket high. And I do, you know, I teach eight week courses to the public, and I just keep seeing it and seeing it. That's people are not classified with a mental health problem. It's people. Like our good selves are suffering on so many different levels. So, yeah, so I'm seeing that, and I think it's really important work I'm doing, actually. So it feels like a whole Extinction Rebellion is like, here comes another Greenham thing. But I think actually
it was interesting how much they were using the techniques of nonviolent direct action as well. Civil disobedience of the suffragettes.
Absolutely.
You could really see the feminist pioneering movements within
absolutely,
their
yeah.
actions,
no, he's,
which I thought was really interesting.
Well, that's what he's done. He's brought about a lot of what people have done in the past as a collective to set this
up. But very specifically women as well, I think.
Yeah, no, which is great, and that's how it should be, isn't it? I think now we are, I mean, I'm very much into the planets and astrology, and what's happening up there, planetary, is very much about dissolving of the patriarchy. And we're going to see a lot of changes.
Do you align with a particular strain of feminism now, like radical or liberal?
I don't know. But where would I put myself? I'm a feminist, and I don't align myself, I don't think. And I think that came through the sense of becoming a healer, seeing a different perspective, and... knowing where I am in that as a woman, and how, you know, I like to be spoken to, or what I feel I'm not afraid to say, and I'm passionate about children and girls having, and women having a voice to actually, you know, consider something, you know, to know there's a choice rather than this is it. Mm. And I think it's... And I'm really enjoying the journey of listening to, you know, the role of women and how that's changing in our society in terms of if it's equal pay. I mean, it is really the matriarchy is really coming up now, and we can see that. That's very obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so, you know, bit by bit. And we've got a way to go, but I think is dissolving. And but then you've got women who, and I don't know if they are feminists, but feeling they have this equality to men and want to be like men. You know, that's where I find that balance for me feels a bit, I don't quite get it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't get it. I'm not saying
it's like Thatcher, isn't it? It's like going in as a woman and taking your token space rather than going in as a feminist and changing the space.
Absolutely.
To allow
more women in. So I feel that, you know, that sense of, and I feel understanding healing from being an acupuncturist, that actually women's energy is different than men's energy, because it is, when, you know, when I used to treat a woman, a man, it is different. It's not better, it's just different. It's different. And I think that allowed me to go, actually, as a woman, we need to take care of our bodies so much more than men, rather than we keep pushing ourselves like the male drive, that we don't have to do that. We can do that in a different way and still be strong and still be equal and powerful. But that's, I've sort of understood that as getting into healing and understanding energy, I think. Mm. That's where I've come from with that.
Yeah. And did you feel that was influenced by Greenham?
Yeah, it's a part of it. Yeah. Absolutely, it has to be, doesn't it? Has to be. Absolutely has to be.
It's quite an influential time of your life, I suppose, 25, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I think, and I'm great, because I think, well, if I hadn't have had that experience, who knows, like any of our experiences, where we are at any given point.
What were your most striking memories of Greenham? When you think of it, what are the memories that are really vivid and important?
Yeah, I think it's like, so many, it's difficult to sort of, you've got the sort of, the real massive coming together, you know, the power that feels as a woman, that when women get together, there's this extraordinary strength, which is difficult to describe, really, actually, that you don't experience it normally, that women from different ages and different backgrounds coming together with the same sort of focus, it gets huge, I think. So that was one end of it, and then just sitting around the fire, you know, getting back into connecting with this old ritual that brings people around the fire, that's always happened, and just sitting and not having to talk, you know, that sense of just sitting with, being quiet, being peaceful, at peace, connecting.
Do you have memories of food and things like that, cooking?
The sort of the primal thing of surviving, you know, for the women that live there, it was surviving. Not for the weekenders like myself, actually. So there was this amazing woman in Ascot called Merle, had some money, got a van, and her thing was to go every night through the winter. It was a very cold, that winter, whenever it was, very, very cold, to take the van out with clean, dry blankets for all the gates and for food for all the gates. So it meant that So that's when I got guys involved. I thought, you know, we don't have to cook as well. So, because we were this great, particularly this area, this very political group. I said, right, who wants to do baked potatoes and chilli? So I was getting like different groups, and then I'd gather it up. And I was in charge of East Reading, where we are now. That was what I did. And went out, because if all your stuff's taken by the bailiffs and the muncher every day, what how do you eat? Even a hot drink, you know. So that was a very practical support.
Did you watch the bailiffs taking stuff?
So if you were on the late duty, so if you're doing night watch between 2 and 6, that's when you would see it, because that's when they would come first thing in the morning. They would get them up, just take everything and put them in this muncher, particularly Bluegate, because they're right by the road. They were very vulnerable. That's why we supported them, I think, because if you're in the woods like Violet, they just didn't go there, you know. And I think they sort of left the Yellow Gate women alone, because they're the ones, you know, the spokespeople, and they were the elders, and somehow they'd got their little caravans, didn't they? So that was quite different for them, where Bluegate was just surviving on sort of levels that you can't imagine. Their hot water bottles were just full of ice.
Were you there during the winter?
Yeah. And a night watch, you just crack on, and keep the fire going. I remember first time we did, there was a few of us. we're not keeping the fire going. We're really useless, you know. How embarrassing. Before they wake up, let's get this fire going. And it's just funny things like that, isn't it? Where it's a funny little memory. But, yeah, and then there was this beauty of, you know, when you're doing that late night watch and the sun comes up and you're sitting there and that stillness of the first morning and sitting. Again, there's something about sitting around a fire, isn't it? Which...
Did you experience or watch, aside from the rocks you said were being thrown over, did you experience or watch any violence from authority figures?
Yeah, I mean, I think because some of the women were, how do I put it? Yeah, were a bit bolder and angrier.
Yeah.
They didn't mind stepping out a bit. And I think whether or not that was, I'm not saying they weren't antagonistic, but they may have been perceived as antagonistic. So there was a bit of ruffling going on,
yeah.
And, you know, sort of bad words and everything. So I saw some of that. And
when you say ruffling?
Yeah, sort of felt like they got a bit too close and, you know, slightly argy-bargy, the sort of pushing. So I know when we were sitting, stopping cruise missiles coming in, you know, I remember I sort of felt this policeman sort of hauled me out a bit, sort of. He could have done it much more kindly.
Yeah.
It didn't hurt me, but it was a sort of sense, you know, come on, get out of the way, and pulled me rather than could have just done that differently. And I remember thinking, wow, if he'd have done it any more, that would have hurt. And you, so the sort of levels you didn't quite know. And I think for some women, they didn't mind that, just observing that, because they didn't care. They didn't care about what they were doing. They cared about being there. Whereas I didn't want to get involved in too much argy-bargy, really.
Did you observe any kind of, or maybe in the night watch team, were there ever challenges and conflicts that you had to overcome? And if so, how did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, again, like I think I began our conversation with, I think, you know, being a non-living Greenham woman, as in living there day-to-day, week-to-week, I think we were seen a bit differently. They were appreciative of what we did, but actually they didn't show that. And sometimes you felt they made you feel a bit silly.
Right.
Sometimes. I'm not saying that, but that didn't bother me because I just thought, well, I don't blame them. Perhaps I would do that if I was them. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to judge that. But I was
interesting, actually, interviewing lots of women who lived there. They just talk about how important the weekenders were and night watch and the people who came in and that to revitalize the camp. So it's interesting. So some women have said, I was only there a little bit, so I don't know if you'll want to speak to me because I only came at weekends. And we were like, no, crucial part of the survival of that camp.
Absolutely.
So I think that's been quite clear actually in the interviews that we've done.
I think as I said before, I think Bluegate was very different.
Yeah,
you know, they were very just radical lesbians who were just on it. Do you know what I mean? Very different from all the other gates. So, but I was quite fascinated with that. Do you know what I mean? I just felt like they were...
Did you know Rebecca Johnson?
No, not personally. I know who she is, but she wasn't really around Bluegate. I think we were sort of very much aligned around that was...
She set it up, though, I think, and maybe moved to another...
Yeah, area. No, but then it just became... the, you know, the 19-year-olds who were and I think what came with that was, again, a lot of young women with a lot of serious mental health, and that's not easy when you're you know, you're a young woman and you don't have, what's the word, like I have the resources now, you know, it sometimes felt a bit scary. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
But I think if you're living there, everyone knows how to be. I remember that there's a woman called Metal Mickey or Metal...
Yeah, Metal Mickey.
Yeah, and that she was quite scary. You know, I remember sort of... just because you just felt like there was an unpredictability about her. But again, she wouldn't bother me now. It was then, you know, being a young woman and having a young child. I just felt there was a vulnerability about me.
What were your memories of Metal Mickey then?
Well, no, it's only once, but I just remember her sort of walking past me and you just... She oozed this aura of... total uniqueness of who she was, and she wasn't afraid, and you know, you just think, wow, what would it be like to be like that? Because I did recognise my fear, you know, it was frightening. I think on different levels for different things, but it didn't put me off going. Do you know what I mean? That was the thing, I think. It was really important to sort of feel the fear and do it anyway, sort of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Terminology.
And so do you remember there being conflict on the camp at all? Or?
It sort of goes in waves, and I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think there was the sense of the conflict between the antagonism from what the soldiers and the army and the police were doing. And then I think for some women, they just wanted to be antagonistic. It was a very little minority, and whether or not because it was the Blue Gates sort of, you know, they just wanted, some wanted to be angry. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing, you know. So I just felt like, you know, some antagonism sets off another bit of antagonism, doesn't it? I mean, it's that whole...
I suppose I just kind of think how hard it must have been to live, just to live and manage a camp.
No, it is. And you just think, as a sort of weekender, you just go, I couldn't do that. Do you know what I mean? Day in, day out. Because it was rough.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
absolutely rough to sort of sleep. There was no sort of blow-up sleeping things. It was rocky, you know. And if they... Sometimes it didn't have a bender. They were sort of sleeping, you know, when we're doing night watch, they would just be sleeping near you, you know, in a sleeping bag. And I think, you know, your whole sense of comfort is eroded, and so you just don't want any hassle.
Yes.
And I could see that, and I could get that. It's almost like I'm just doing this, and I'm here, and they're doing their best, aren't they? So it's easy for me to sort of come in and go, God, what's all this antagonism? But actually, they've got every right to be that.
Yeah.
Anybody would be. I'd probably be doing that, you know, day
and
as
you say, there was so much peacefulness and organisation as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's almost like, you know, how do we survive all this? What do we do in order to get all to get together all through this together? You know, we must do this and carry everybody with all kinds of issues, problems. Do you know what I mean? It felt like people carried each other, and even though I wasn't used to what was going on, I just felt like I just embraced it and thought, wow, you know, this is teaching me a lot here. It was a real lesson to understand, you know, to develop compassion, actually, which was really important.
Do you talk about Greenham very much?
I do. In fact, I was in the hairdresser, should I get my hair cut? And I said, oh, I like my hairdresser. But suddenly went silent, and it went really silent. I could tell people were listening. And then I realised, yeah, when we bought common land back, you know, you're sort of trying to sort of turn it into like, so yeah, I walked my dog there. I went, yeah, because some of us sort of made sure that happened, you know, trying to turn it into like, so they can get it. Because if you go too heavily into the sort of politics, people just go like that.
Yeah.
Or like you're a dirty Greenham woman.
And what do you think your son feels?
No, he's very proud.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know he is. I know he is.
Do you think that your politics must have impacted him?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I've always sort of come from a sort of Labour family. My grandfather was a coal miner. And... So Labour has always been the politics, but actually, I sort of, being a healer, I've gone right into sort of the last 25 years being the Green Party, just because I feel that makes sense to me, you know, about the planet and everything. And he's sort of married a very sort of political Labour person. She did politics at Reading, so he's getting it from all angles.
Do you feel your feminism impacted him when you were raising him?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I do. I think, and it's quite emotional talking about him because I think he's quite extraordinary, really. We've got a very, very close relationship, and I'm very proud of him on so many levels, really.
Yeah.
And, he was part of the journey, and
he was there, wasn't he?
Yeah,
really?
And saw me with that hair, saw me, you know, looking like Sinead O'Connor, and and there's no sort of and still have that very close relationship, and we still have, and yeah. we'd always have, you yeah. know. And I've done all sorts of alternative things throughout my life, and he's been there all the way along the journey, really, and sort of will laugh in a good way, you know, rather than a sort of derogatory.
Did you feel you learnt about motherhood when you were at Greenham? From other mothers that were there?
Yeah, I didn't see a lot of mums there because they were in the woods. So the Violet Gate was the... It's a shame, really, because I think, for me, that would have been a great gate to support.
Yeah.
But somehow it felt like Blue Gate was where we went. Went to... yeah, because my mum had gone... My mum and dad... I grew up in Africa. My mum and dad went back to do some work there. So my mum wasn't around. My mum and dad weren't around when I was doing Greenham. And I got very close with this German woman who was similar age to my mum. So she was arrested on the bonfire night. She was the one that, so she wanted to go to court with her name and wanted to go to Holloway. So she arrived in this suit with this like calico knapsack, you know, like a burglar would have. And the judge was her age and he did not want to send her. He felt very uncomfortable and he didn't. So me and her got very, very close. I think she never had a daughter. My mum was in Africa and it felt like we had this lovely sort of symbiotic relationship.
Still in touch?
Sadly, she died. But we had, this is another lovely story. It was a Sunday and she goes, oh, do you fancy, should we just have a Sunday afternoon in Greenham? Where should we go? And we said, oh, let's go to Orange Gate. And again, that was...
Years later, you mean? Or?
No, at that time.
Oh, at the time.
Yeah, right. Okay. So we went to Orange Gate, which again was off the beaten track a bit. And woman said, who fancies a Sunday afternoon drive? And so we went, yeah, all right then. So it's just cut this massive square and we just drove in. And I can always remember she had a tape and it was...
drove into where, sorry?
Into the base. So drove through the fence. She just said, okay, let's just cut a thing. Drove in and me and Inga were... and it was the song All the Leaves Are Brown, California Dreaming.
On the radio.
Yeah, and I just love that song. I always remember just going around like, let's just go for a Sunday afternoon drive.
What happened when you went in?
Yeah, we went around. We were there for quite a while. And then we were stopped and interrogated and luckily just told to go rather than get out, let's arrest you and all that.
Yeah.
And
because they were doing the strip searches at that point on the arrests, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I wasn't involved in that, thank goodness. That must have been horrendous, actually. Yeah. Horrendous. Absolutely. Yeah. The worst. And what was interesting at that time, because I was an art teacher, I got offered a job at Reading Prison, teaching art to the young remanders, the guys there. And I was just studying to be an acupuncturist. So I was quite intrigued with the whole thing of what's going on here then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was hard for me. And it was scary. It was, again, my life has been so many things like oh, what am I doing here? How did I get here? What led me to this place? That is the story of my life, you know, sort of, hold on a minute. maybe I chose to. it was...
Do you remember what the base was like when you drove into it? Do you describe it for us?
Yeah, well, it's interesting driving through the fence. There was no gate.
Yeah.
Because there was the gate there, which we couldn't get through, and they just clipped this great big square. It was surreal. It felt like, this isn't really happening. How does this happen? How do you, one minute just sitting there and someone just says, let's do that. Yeah, all right. Do you want to come? Yeah, okay. And I looked at my German friend and we were going, oh my God, you know, these women are just, lack of fear, just didn't give a monkeys. And we were going, yeah, okay. No, recognising that in ourselves and recognising it now. But feeling this expansiveness, like I said before about Bonfire Night, about trying to get across this runway, it went on for it wasn't miles, but you just felt like it was never ending trying to get across it. It wasn't like a road, it was a massive highway.
Yeah.
And so you're in there and you felt like, whoa, you could just see as far as the eye could see, because obviously when you're behind the fence, you just don't see that. there's things in the way, and we were just like driving around. And I thought, this is huge. There's nothing happening here. There shouldn't be a fence here. There should not be a fence, and there should not be cruise missiles on here either. And there shouldn't be nobody on here because, you know, this has been planted, and this was never. It's always meant to be a common. So,
are you in touch with many of the women now?
Yeah, my friend who started the Greenham support group, because our daughters were the same. We got quite close when our daughters went to the same school around the corner. She's moved out of Reading, so she's the one that started the Greenham support group, and she started the telephone tree. There was this telephone tree that we were all on, and men were on that as well. And what was interesting was, because in those days we had, you know, like the old style phone, and mine was on, I used to rent a house over the park that way, and it was on the wall, and I know that every time the phone went, somebody else being tapped, you could hear all sorts of strange noises. So someone obviously got my number from somewhere.
Right.
And yeah, so it's just being really careful of that as well. Yeah. So it was, for me, it was interesting because I think it was the Greenham, and it was connected in with this Red Rag magazine, with all the things that were going on and all the support that came behind that, with all sorts of people, and real respect for what we were doing, and real support and real encouragement, and always it needed to be written about what was happening weekly in this. It was, you know, going around to a lot of people in Reading, this magazine. And
I was just going to say, I can't remember what I was going to say, actually. Sorry.
That happens at my age.
So Greenham has a very kind of small, little, tiny space on some syllabuses, but it's kind of like an optional thing within a history module or a politics module.
Mm.
It's not really well taught in the UK. Do you think that's one of the reasons that... Because obviously one of the reasons for this project is that actually it's remarkable how little people know
about
Greenham.
Well, and it's funny, and then it's remarkable how much people do know.
Younger generation, definitely.
I
think a lot of the older people remember it in the press.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think, on lots of levels of, you know, the press made Greenham women to be, you know, dirty, you know, bad-mouthed women. I mean, I know I've mentioned that a little bit, but that's in to do with surviving, and because people have no idea. And some people don't know what really happened and didn't want to know. So I think there's a lot of lack of understanding, a lack of education. And it was a massive bit of history, because we achieved what we wanted to achieve. That's massive. That was huge. Huge, you know.
Were you there when Cruise left?
Yeah. And because it's just, I mean, it's great to be just up the road. I mean, I think, well, if I'd have been in France, I probably would have done, I think, because it was quite unique. I think it was the first women's peace camp in the UK, wasn't it? I think it was. I think it was one in
certainly
Europe.
Certainly of that size, I think.
Yeah. So that's why I think it attracted. So I think it does need to have a much bigger place in history, particularly.
Why do you think it hasn't?
I don't know. Bloody Ofsted. I don't know, really. being a teacher, I think. Yeah, you know, is it something to do with women's politics? You know, that. Who's driving this syllabus, and, you know, what they perceive as important. And but it is history, and it did achieve, and it was very much to do with the Cold War and what was going on. And that was a very sort of potent time, I think. And that is on the Cold War is on the syllabus. So you think, why isn't Greenham on this? Yeah. A little bit bigger, you know.
Yeah.
And you just wonder who is there going, no, yes, maybe. Who's in charge of those decisions? But I know I've talked about it a lot, and 9 times out of 10 people going, wow, that was fantastic, you know, well done you. I always get really positive things, you know, because I don't think there's a lot of us around here. Do you know what I mean? I do feel, because women were sprinkled all over the place, weren't they?
Yeah.
And the people that I knew in Reading have moved on, and I mean, there's a woman I contacted who's living in Ireland, and she's working with refugee women. And I said, Laura, I can't find my photographs. Have you got any photos? You know, so she was here living going with me, and she's now somewhere else, and she was saying, oh yeah, my daughter who went to Royal College of Art, she keeps asking me about it, you know. And then when I took my daughter, so I've got 10 years between my son and my daughter, so when I had my daughter, she was about 9 when the mayor of Newbury was saying it's common land, so she came with me, and that whole cycle of ending it with her as a 9-year-old girl, and she's very intrigued, and you know, she's 25 now, and she's very sort of proud, and do you know what I mean, sort of wants to know information. Yeah. And
what do you think the legacy of Greenham is?
That women weren't afraid to face this massive, you know, the massive power of cruise missiles and dictators, and who were trying to say, you know, this, you know, we sort of faced something that was quite colossal, I think, in sisterhood, and with real sort of diligence of, you know, we're in for the long haul here. We're not giving up. You know, so easy, I think, a lot of groups going, all right, we haven't got what we want, let's go. I mean, it was that sort of persistence, that sense of...
It was years and years.
Yeah, enduring women's energy where we, you know, we've got that because we can bring children up. We have that. I mean, I remember in my healing thing, I'm very much follow the Buddhist philosophy, and someone said to the Dalai Lama once, what's the most spiritual thing a person can do? And he said, just turn to any mother in this audience.
Right.
And that is about devotion, isn't it? The sense of women have this sense of devotion about we can really care about something, and we're willing to put all of ourselves into it in a different way than a man does it, I think. You know, they want...
I suppose we've been encouraged to do that, haven't we, by society?
Yeah. But I think...
Because I think there's lots of women at Greenham and lots of women in the world who aren't maternal and... Mm.
No, I agree. I think because being a woman, we have this sense of... caring, which is very different. It comes from a much more, like you said, it is a maternal caring, which is different from a caring, and that sense of connection. I think women have extraordinary connection with each other. Women who don't know each other can connect. We don't have to know. I know. I feel I'm connected with you, and I don't know you, and I wouldn't feel the same if two guys were interviewing me.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just saying that as a different.
I mean, I think women only spaces really.
Yeah, absolutely. And that women-only space, I think, because all sorts of things were written. There's a peace camp at Molesworth, wasn't there? They think at the same time. And there's all kinds of, you know, women getting raped and argy-bargy. And you're just thinking, why would you go there as a woman? Why would you? You know, it's complicated, isn't it, I think. But for me, I knew what that opened up for me, what it confirmed to me, that I felt very humbled to be part of all that, actually.
And I think as well, like, I suppose the women who were at Greenham who were mothers will have had such a political awakening that fed down to their children.
Absolutely.
And the next generation.
No, I totally, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah. I do feel I'm not afraid. I'm on local radio quite regularly on the wellbeing programme, and I have rung up sometimes. This is way back in Radio 4, something's happened, and I'm not afraid to say my bit in it, really. Yeah. I think people just need to know the truth. I think, you know, this whole thing, what people think, what they assume or perceive, it's not the truth, and I think it's really important to represent your personal truth.
Yeah. In terms of nuclear threat today, how do you feel that's changed?
I don't know. Has it changed? It's just different, isn't it? It's different. You've got nutters, haven't you, in America that could
always.
Easily, yeah. but particularly, and you know, but I think we have to be very careful coming from the healing aspect of how we tap into our fear, because it is a fear, isn't it, rather than a reality. And if we're tapping into fear all the time, we sort of create that on other levels of our well-being and our health, and we forget this beautiful world that we live in, actually. You know, just sitting here and listening to the birds feeling the sun on our face. And that's real. This is in the moment. This is what I teach with mindfulness. And that, to me, has opened up another way of being happy on the planet, really. And I think Greenham was a sort of sense of... making another, creating that happiness on the planet by getting rid of that, those horrible weapons of mass destruction, and having this land that the planet so needs, you know. And what happens within that was just this extraordinary adventure of and tangents that went out with it.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult question to answer, but I don't know if I have answered it really.
No, I think you answered it really beautifully. I think that's a really lovely way to end the interview, actually, unless you wanted to add.
No, I think I've said quite a lot, actually.